Hello, this is the podcast for our class on October 20th, and it's class number 16. And we're continuing to talk about our element of cause and fact. Remember, negligence is established. Negligence is established. Now we've moved on to cause in fact. So, last class we talked about our regular rule of proving cause in fact, but for causation, remember, but for the negligence of the defendant, the injury wouldn't have occurred. That's a regular rule then, and we've, you know, ordinarily most cases can be decided by this. It's not anything that you need to go into great detail. If you can, you say, but for, one sentence will solve the problem. But for is 100%. You can't say it's not a correlation. Remember in Stubbs, a good correlation, but correlation doesn't mean causation. And even 99% is not but for. So if you don't have our but-for test met, there are other options for you. Of course, we used, you know, reasonable certainty, substantial factor we've seen, even under Ben. But again, anything under 100%, you haven't shown but-for causation. Doesn't mean that it's not enough evidence to, in order to make a jury decision, but for is absolutely 100% certain. Then we talked about the test, the cases where when but for doesn't work, it can be very difficult to show causation. So we talked about first the Zukowicz test. What was the negligence? The negligence was the overdose of this Danicrin. The impossibility was a but-for linking of the negligence, that is the overdose, to the injury, that's the PPH. Why was it impossible? Because it's an overdose. They hadn't tested overdoses. We know that just regular Danicrin prescription didn't do it, but this was an area that it's impossible to test. No studies have been done. Even if it was a little more than the maximum allowable amount, they'd never tested it to this particular extent. So Danicrin doesn't cause PPH, but question whether the overdose did. And we had medical experts say, well, they ruled out every other possibility, and the timing was right, so it was good enough. And the judge allowed this medical testimony under the very open rules of the Daubert case. So the medical testimony was admissible, and it was enough for a reasonable jury to provide a decision on causation. Circumstantial evidence such as this is enough, maybe enough, to get you to the jury. It's the same inquiry that we saw with the question of breach, just the sufficiency of the evidence, because cause in fact is a question of fact. So a lot of what we talked about in breach is this enough evidence is also good for a discussion of cause in fact. We did the hypothetical involving the negligence and the injury, the negligently lighted stairs, body at the bottom. Make sure you understand why we did that. We did that in order to show what sort of circumstantial evidence can be used to show this one way or the other, either that the lighting was the cause or that it was something else that led to the broken neck. So again, when we don't know what the cause was, circumstantial evidence can provide enough so that there can be an inference. Remember, all we need is an inference. But an inference isn't a speculation. And remember that we have to make sure that we're not just guessing, that there's enough evidence to provide an inference of causation. Then we moved to Albert Stoltz. Here it was, we had negligence, and we knew the negligence didn't cause the ultimate injury, which was the amputation of the leg, but the court had to decide whether to accept a new cause of action, which was the loss of a chance that the leg could have been saved. The cause of action isn't negligence causing the amputation, but it's negligence causing the loss of an opportunity that perhaps there wouldn't have to be an amputation. So our new cause of action, new for New Mexico anyway, revolved around if the jury could decide by the probability of the evidence, by probability, a reasonable probability, the jury could decide by 51% their regular burden of proof, that was more likely than not that the negligence caused the loss of a 20% chance. Was there enough evidence to get this to the jury? Is there enough evidence so that a reasonable jury could reach that decision, that more likely than not, the negligence caused the loss of a chance, that chance may be? And the court here said, well, we'll allow this cause of action, and if we do, they decided the damages should be apportioned. But the case here failed because there wasn't, the court just decided not enough evidence so that a jury could decide by a preponderance of the evidence that the negligence caused the loss of a chance. Question, of course, as the dissent did, is the majority just over, do they want a 100% chance? Because the expert said they could have probably found a good artery had there been good medical records taken. So, again, a different causation problem. Couldn't cause the injury, but we have a cause of a loss of a chance. And that's, again, what is it that they caused? So here, you need to provide a link between the negligence and some kind of injury, some kind of cause of action. Then we moved to talking about multiple defendants. Up until now, everything had been a single defendant. Now we have multiple defendants, and you have to understand how important joint and several liability is when there are multiple defendants. The theory of joint and several liability means that each negligent defendant is responsible for what they caused and what everybody else caused too. 100%. Only go after one. You can't get more than 100%. But if you can get one solvent defendant under joint and several liability, you can get your entire recovery, even though there are a number of equally negligent defendants. So joint and several liability is a rule of liability that allows you to recover all of your damages from just one of the negligent defendants. If the liability is several only, it means that each defendant is only liable for their own negligence, for what they caused. So for multiple defendants, so the big thing is to be able to get joint and several liability, and they're very different. There's some different theories of multiple defendant liability that will enable you to do that. Joint tortfeasors, a concerted action. One or more had agreed to act negligently. Visible injury. Get joint and several liability. The injury, it can't be apportioned. You cannot divide it so that each is responsible for their own, so that each negligent party in an individual injury is going to be responsible for the whole. And then concurrent action. Somebody comes negligent one after the other, you're going to be responsible for the whole. So we're not apportioning fault in joint and several liability. We're apportioning causation. But it's a great tool for the plaintiff because it allows you to recover the whole thing from only one or two of a bunch of negligent defendants. Summers v. Tice is another way of providing liability or joint and several liability for when there are multiple defendants. And it's the Summers v. Tice is the rule of alternative liability. Two negligent defendants damage could only have come from one. So one of the two, out of the two negligent defendants, one is clearly responsible and our plaintiff is an innocent victim. In this situation, the court has afforded a shift in the burden of proof so that the defendants themselves have to show who is responsible. If neither can do that, both are going to be responsible jointly and severally. And this is a big deal because the odds are that only it's a 50-50 proposition that one or the other did it. So this is going below, alternative liability puts us below our preponderance of the evidence. You know, it's definitely preponderance of the evidence that one of them did it, but we don't know who. But we're, under this situation, we're saying it doesn't really matter. It's a policy question that our innocent plaintiff recovers. And without this, our plaintiff would have had to show that they were acting in concert to get joint and several liability. There was no way to apportion this injury so that these two negligent defendants would have gotten off. Then we talked about substantial factor rule from Section 432. Make sure you understand that. And we went over several hypotheticals to talk about liability. Under substantial factor. And then the notion of apportionment. Page 373, apportion of damages should be done by causation, not by fault. You should only be have to pay for what you caused. So apportion your damages. Pay for what you cause. If you can't apportion them, then we look to other ways. We look for a substantial factor. We look for some type of estimate of factual likelihood, type of factual likelihood supplanted by an estimate of quantity. How much is it likely? Okay, so for next class, we're going to finish up cause in fact with Heimovitz v. Eli Lilly and move on to proximate cause. So next class, finish up negligence and move to proximate cause.